Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:18 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 21st, the longest day of the year, and it is quadruple witching on Wall Street. So there was a little bit of a pause in terms of the advances that we've seen in stock markets in here today. But generally speaking, these quadruple witching days don't really amount to much other than a little bit of volatility ahead of the event rather than after the event. So we'll see what happens next week. But I thought I would kick off this week with the Shiller PE ratio because there's been a great deal of commentary about it because we are back at levels that haven't been seen since 1929. The only other time that the level has been exceeded was back in 2000. And obviously, we are at high levels relative to history, and we have plenty of history. So, this obviously raises some important questions. Is the market ridiculously overvalued at the present moment? Are we in a completely different scenario, that the advent of globalization has increased the earnings capacity of companies? The growth potential is therefore global rather than local. That's, I think, a rational argument, at least to justify the higher multiple that we see on markets. But it's a tenuous argument. The most compelling argument for why valuations are where they are is because of the willingness of central banks to print money. That is front and center here in here this week because the ECB is talking about negative interest rates. The Federal Reserve has opened the door to an interest rate cut next month. So we are entering another loosening cycle is probably the best way to think about it. If we've just been through a tightening cycle, and it was a very modest tightening cycle, but it does appear to be over. We're seeing an increasingly large number of central banks cutting interest rates, and that's important because it's a key arbiter of just how much liquidity is out there in the market to support prices. What the Shiller PE ratio tells us is that we are starting to enter rarefied territory. But it does not tell us how high the valuations are going to go. There's nothing on the chart that says that this expansion in valuations is over. I think that's the most important factor. Value investors are predisposed to fall into this trap. Value investing works best after a major market decline. That's where people that have got forensic analytical skills that can go through a number of shares, look at their fundamentals, look at their ability to cover their costs, look at things like price to sales ratio, price to book ratios on an historic basis, look at businesses that have got tangible assets that have the capacity to generate income over the medium to longer term. These are the kinds of things that value investors excel at, and after major market declines, they get a wonderful opportunity to put that skill set to use. And that's also where the majority of the outperformance from value funds originates. It's all about the entry point. Well, that same skill set is uniquely unsuited to a momentum-driven market when valuations are no longer as attractive as they were at the lows. And we are quickly entering that kind of scenario. What's obviously being purveyed here is that the mean value for the index is 16 and two-thirds, and the median is 15 and three-quarters. And right now it's at 30, so it's double the median value. Well, that is obviously of a concern to value investors because they are looking at their 10-year horizons. And when you look at 10-year horizons from this kind of perspective, then you're going to get a very uncertain outcome. The the 10-year horizon, when you've got a valuation at this level, is going to be really low. But that tells us nothing about what the valuation is going to be a year hence or 2 years hence. It doesn't tell us whether it could be even worse, whether the expected return on a 10-year basis is going to be even lower in future. What it also tends to ignore is that when markets fall, they tend to fall much faster than they rise. And that corrects valuations really very quickly. Then, when you start thinking about 10-year horizons, then you can start to, again, it just further highlights that value investing works best after a major decline. It does absolutely nothing to tell us about the capacity for a market to enter a bubble. And it is bubble risk, and perhaps a better way of characterizing it is bubble opportunity, that is, I think, front and center now in terms of this market. If we think very logically, or just simply look at the way that markets work, when central banks embarked on the quantitative easing strategy, this was an entirely new departure. It was a massive source of additional new liquidity, and it had a massive effect on the supply of liquidity to the global markets. Well, I've created this chart of the total assets of central banks, and I do think that it is highly relevant to this discussion because it really took off in 2008. This was a massive change in terms of the trajectory of the quantity of money sitting on central bank balance sheets. The very clear intention was to massively increase the supply of money in order to compensate for the disastrous fall in the velocity of money during the financial crisis. Now we have a market that is addicted to liquidity. And what I think we have seen with every other major bull market in terms of new financial innovations and their application to asset prices is that people take what was an idea at the beginning and they push it to its logical and eventually illogical extreme. In other words, they keep pushing it until something breaks. And I think that that is now where we are with this system, that we are at a point where the ECB is very clearly stating that they don't think that quantitative easing is the kind of thing that is going to get inflation back upwards. So they're talking about moving interest rates into negative territory. What they're obviously not talking about is the political intransigence that is evident within the EU that is stopping them from re-engaging with quantitative easing. And of course, they don't have any choice in terms of fiscal stimulus because trying to get the European governments to veer away from their fiscal austerity, which is really in place to try and control moral hazard rather than any real ambition to foment growth. Well, there is no way that they're going to move away from that regard in the absence of a very clear external crisis. An internal crisis in the Eurozone wasn't enough to change it, so an external crisis is probably going to be required to get them to move away from that fiscal austerity. Either that, or it's going to have to be the realignment of debt GDP ratios, which isn't expected to happen until about 2030, before they can start to really implement a unified fiscal budget within the EU. But what's particularly important in here this week is that the total assets of central banks has broken up out of this short-term range. It's now increasingly looking like a failed downside break below about the 19.3 trillion level, and it's quite likely that with some pressure coming to bear on the US dollar, that we are going to see the value of assets sitting on other central banks around the world increasing as a result, and that will move the needle in terms of global liquidity. The dollar index is right in the region of the trend mean. And Now is the question whether it is going to break the uptrend. What we're definitely seeing is that the USA is now removing supports from the dollar. When we think about what has been the primary motivation behind this rally over the course of the last 18 months, it's primarily been the trend downwards in the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And there was a knee-jerk response to that right at the beginning of the quantitative tightening program. But now the dollar is losing impetus because the Federal Reserve is going to stop reducing the size of its balance sheet in September. Now they're going to start cutting interest rates as well. So that is removing two very important supports from the bull market for the dollar. There is a real potential here that the dollar is going to weaken further from here. I think that it has to be the base case at this stage. But it's going to require a sustained move below that trend mean to really confirm that that is in fact going to be the case. Well, that's particularly bad news for Europe. That's an additional reason why they are getting antsy about the size of, or I guess antsy about the value of the euro. And the euro was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. It's the mirror image of the dollar index. Europe talking about moving into negative interest rates. If they can then also try to weaken the euro, that is going to create a massive carry trade. With euro being one of the most liquid currencies and negative interest rates are already at zero, and almost all of the German yield curve is in negative territory. You have to go out to maturities of almost 20 years before you can find a positive yield in Germany or indeed in France. And that already creates a carry trade opportunity. It's only the missing ingredient would be a further weakening of the euro to really start to get it moving again. So that's obviously going to be a priority for the Eurozone. They don't want to have a strong currency, but right now the USA is doing more. Rather than talking about it, they're doing more to weaken the dollar. And that is beneficial to liquidity, and most particularly, it's beneficial to nominal stock prices. And the S&P 500 had pushed on to another new all-time high yesterday. But perhaps the most important thing that we've seen over the course of the last few months has been this big upside weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean 3 weeks ago. And the index is now at a new all-time high. Well, it has raced to get up here. It wouldn't be too surprising if we see some consolidation in this area. But the handy thing now is that if this is going to break on the upside, if this is the end of this medium-term correction, which began at the beginning of 2018, then the lows put in back at the end of May should hold. So this market has room in which to consolidate and still be a breakout candidate. The Dow Jones Industrials Average is right in the region of the upper side of its range, and it is within just a couple of points of breaking up and out of this range. Now, that was a major pullback that we saw in the third, excuse me, the fourth quarter of last year, and an equally impressive rebound. What I think is worth highlighting is that back at the lows at the end of last year, approximately 80% of issues on the NYSE were trading below their trend mean, and that was coinciding with the same level that we saw back in 2015 and 16, and again in 2011. The only time it's been exceeded in the course of the last 20 odd years was in 2008. And we've had a meaningful rebound since then. The much bigger question now is this going to continue higher? It would be natural for this to continue higher if we do see the market breaking on the upside. A fairly limited number of shares have already broken on the upside. And when we then think about the advanced decline line, well, That's also something that I think people will be paying attention to. For example, when we think about the outlook for the index, well, the advanced decline line, which is the number of advancing issues minus the number of declining issues, has been hitting new all-time highs for just about all of June. And it has been trending higher in a pretty consistent manner for much of the last decade. In fact, it was also a reasonably impressive lead indicator for the pullback in 2008, because it actually peaked in 2007 and had been trending down right at the beginning of 2008. It makes logical sense that if we're going to have a bear market, then the number of decliners should exceed the number of advancing issues. So we would then anticipate that this index would start to trend downwards in anticipation of a recession. And that, I think, has been one of the big questions. There was, I think, a rather interesting graphic that BCA came out with over the last while, where they put side by side the case for Fed rate cuts against versus the case against it. What is particularly interesting here, and I think it's a point well made, is that the primary case for cutting interest rates is global in nature. You have the global manufacturing PMIs are negative, but US manufacturing is not. When you look at the TIPS breakevens, well, inflation expectations have been trending downwards, and that's also very much in tune with the compression that we've had in government bond yields. I think that this inverted treasury yield curve is not nearly as relevant at the present moment as I think many people are making out, but nonetheless, there is definitely a flat yield curve, and portions of the yield curve are inverted. The trade-weighted dollar has been particularly strong, and now there are measures underway to try and weaken the currency. I think that has been one of the primary points. And then you have the uncertainty index because of the trade war, because of the rise of populism, and the anti-globalization sentiment that has been rising over the last few years. That's an important matter. But again, these issues are global in nature. Now, if we think about the points against cutting interest rates, well, the stock market is still really quite firm, and credit spreads are not trending higher. They've been largely on pause. Unemployment is still very low, and leading indicators are starting to turn around. So that's positive. And then when we think about average hourly earnings, well, they have been trending higher, and they're at the upper side of their range. Well, when we start to think about those factors, well, there is an argument for why we shouldn't be raising interest rates. Now, I think I saw this this chart, and I posted this report in Comment of the Day yesterday. It's the Cass Freight Report. We had a massive inventory build at the end of last year, in anticipation of the additional tariffs that were going to be imposed on Chinese imports at the end of 2018. And the unwinding of that inventory build has been one of the factors that has contributed to this perception that growth was going to slow down in the USA this year. Well, now we've seen the unwinding of that inventory build, there is the logical potential that we're going to start to see demand picking back up again. There is obviously going to be a clear intention by buyers of goods to try and diversify away from China, just to avoid these 25% tariffs. Apple has already done that. They are now manufacturing iPhones in India to supply the US market, and therefore avoiding the tariffs. They're still going to be producing lots of phones in China for the global market. I think this is one of the more important points. The other is that when we look at chemical carloads, it has pulled back violently, but it is rebounding. So when we start to think about the indicators for potential uptick in growth, they are already starting to turn. And the prospect of an interest rate cut is going to further boost liquidity and therefore investor interest. And what we also know is that because the stock market has been range bound for much of the last 18 months, that supply and demand had come back into balance. And when supply and demand come back into balance, the bullish and bearish arguments come back into balance. That means that the bears become more vocal than they would have done, for example, in 2017 when the market just went up. We've had a lot of people talking about a recession. We've had people talking about a crash. We've had people talking about the current environment being similar to the 1930s, the potential for an outright war, the potential that we're in a new Cold War, global war, trade war. All of these things are rational arguments. There is a real potential that these are the kinds of things that do become relevant in the medium term, but perhaps not in the short term. And against that background, we also know that ranges are explosions waiting to happen, and that the big upside key reversal we saw 3 weeks ago and upside follow through in here this week is consistent with the potential that this market is going to break on the upside. Now, that holds out the prospect that we are entering the bubble phase, that we need to have the bubble first, that one thing we know is that liquidity provision has been the number one factor in supporting this market. There are now two forms of liquidity. The first is central bank balance sheets and central bank printing. But over the course of the last couple of years, we have also had deficit spending. And the two primary avenues for deficit spending have been China and the USA. Well, we've had another reading on this index, and deficit spending at the moment is $953 billion this year. Well, that's still a lot of money, and it represents a massive stimulus. So when we start to think about the outlook for growth, the outlook for the liquidity fuel that could potentially drive a new leg higher in this bull market, we're starting to see the factors falling into place. Modern monetary theory represents the ultimate in terms of liquidity provision, because it would represent an open-ended promise to expand deficits into infinity. And we're currently at $950 billion, but if we look back at the last 7 or 8 years, this is about as much deficit spending as governments have been willing to introduce globally. China and the USA are the big deficit spenders at the moment. Europe has not yet started to really spend on the deficit front. It's looking, though, increasingly likely that not only will Angela Merkel not be running in the next election, but that the Green Party is likely to win the next election in Germany. And that is a significant challenge, because that's a left-wing populist, and they have a very clear agenda. So that would start to question the ability of Europe to continue to hold the fiscal line. Most importantly is that they're going to need to start spending if they're going to arrest the advance of the euro, wherein the most likely scenario is in this potential scenario or environment that's evolving, where Wall Street has the potential to break out on the upside and run, that it's going to twin with the potential for a currency war, that the USA wants a weaker currency, they are using their currency in fact as a trade weapon. And that is going to make exports more expensive. And for China and for Europe in the USA, which is the primary consumer. And obviously, that could potentially start to tick up inflation in the USA, but it would be really bad news for places like Europe in particular. Well, the only way that they're going to address that fact is to devalue the currency. Well, right now, the USA is at the point where they are starting to devalue their currency. The Asia dollar index was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. This is the biggest upward dynamic we've seen in years, and it suggests that the period of weakness for Asian currencies is coming to an end. And then when we think about the Latin America dollar index, well, that has been trending down in line with commodity prices since 2011, but it is now right in the region of the trend mean, and there is potential here that it is going to break on the upside. One of the things that we've been discussing in comment of the day in here this week has been the outlook for the commodity markets versus the equity markets. And when we start to think about that question, there are two important ratios. One would be the commodity index divided by the S&P. When we look at this on a long-term basis, it's very important to look at the indices that it's made up by. Because when we look at the absolute index, we don't get nearly the same picture as we do when we look at it on a total return basis. When we think about the outlook for the index and simply think about the S&P in nominal terms, but the commodities in total return, then we get a very different picture. And I think that is the kind of picture that people are starting to think about, in that commodity prices are back at relative lows that we haven't seen since the early 1970s. The most important point with this index is that despite the machinations we've had in the stock market over the last week, it has not moved. In fact, it is continuing to contract. I'm rather cautious about using this ratio because it's using a total return metric for commodities, but not for stocks. And I don't know how they're calculating the total return on those commodities. They're obviously picking up a carry. When we think about the difference that you get when you look at the total return on the equity market, you get a very, very different picture. But one thing we do know is that commodity prices are low, and they're low for a number of reasons, but the most important of which is that there was a massive amount of money spent on increasing supply during the commodity bull. And you're going to have to see demand increasing to overwhelm that supply in order to really demonstrate that we have the potential for another major bull market. Now, the other point, of course, is that one of the flattering factors in terms of the compression of this ratio has been the outperformance of the stock market, driven by liquidity and the increasing weighting of mega cap shares on the index. If we do move into a bubbly phase, then the valuations on some of these companies is going to get truly extraordinary. And when that eventually corrects, it will move this index simply by virtue of the fact that prices fall faster than they rise. But I personally think that the Dow oil ratio is a better measure because we're looking at nominal prices. And what this suggests is that the outperformance of stocks versus oil is going to continue. And we have lots of back history. And we have, in fact, got four major cycles. And this one is the fifth. And in that time, we've had major bull markets in both oil and equities. Now, ratios like this do not tell us what the terminal values in nominal terms of the constituent prices are going to be. But they do tell us which one is likely to outperform over the long term. And that is still very much in equity's favor. When we even look at the Dow gold ratio, then we've had a meaningful move in gold in here this week. And there is the potential that gold is going to outperform in the short term. Over the long term, it's quite likely that equities are going to continue to outperform. But we definitely know that even in the course of a secular bull market, there have been some swinging pullbacks. And that does appear to be what may be underway right now. Because gold is starting to respond to the important fact that this next move higher is going to be predicated on massive liquidity provision and the debasement in the purchasing power of fiat currencies. That's the primary argument behind supporting modern monetary theory. We're already moving in that direction. I think it's quite arguable that the kind of pressure that the Federal Reserve is being put under, the fact that the Trump administration is it's populist in nature. They would probably argue that they are not overly influencing the Federal Reserve, that politicians castigating the Fed has been almost a tradition in the U.S. markets over decades. But what we do know is that there is the potential that the Federal Reserve and the federal government are going to move more hand in hand in terms of deficit spending and funding that deficit. And it's the dollar is going to take that pressure. Something that we've seen over the course of the last couple of days is that stocks, bonds, gold, and oil all rallied at the same time. And the only way that that generally happens is when the dollar falls. Well, gold is at a new six-year high. It is back above the $1,400 area, or at least it was for a brief time in here today. Now, it has rallied $100 in the space of just 4 weeks. So it is not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we get some consolidation in here. What's truly going to demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment is if it can hold the $1,350 area. Every single other occasion in the last 6 years that it has got up to these levels, it has failed. And it is failed breaks above $1,350 has been the hallmark of this base formation. So it needs to hold that would be the first area of potential support, and then the trend mean would be the second area of potential support. If it can do that, then we are back in a demand-dominated environment. Now, this is, I think, a pivotal area for gold prices because it is finally starting to reflect the reality of central bank liquidity provision. And gold shares are finally starting to take notice. Gold miners ETF has now broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It has put in a higher reaction low, and it is up rather significantly, about 25% over the course of the last 4 weeks. Considering how low the prices are relative to the peak back in 2011, there is ample potential here for additional upside. There is also a rather significant number of gold miners that have got production, or all-in production costs, in the region of $750 to $900. And with gold at $1,400, they have got ample scope to pay down debt, pay dividends, and to offer leverage to the gold price. Gold miners have been shy in large part about spending a large amount of money. They have had to start being very clear about their all-in sustaining costs. These are the kinds of changes that occur during a secular bear market, which has, or I guess, a bear market over the last decade that has conditioned them to be very careful about spending. One of the reasons why the gold mining sector did badly, and certainly badly on a relative basis compared to gold in the period up to the peak in 2011, was because they were spending money hand over fist. They were assuming that gold prices would always rise and that they could spend anything because it would be recouped by ever higher prices. That was a very significant factor in people's preferences for simply buying ETFs that tracked the gold price rather than investing in gold miners. In fact, it is right at this point in the cycle that gold miners generally tend to do best, because they haven't been spending a lot of money on on mine expansion. When we think about the gold miners ETF, it doesn't go all the way back to the lows in 2000, so the Gold Bugs Index does. It was at incredibly depressed levels back in 2000 and 2001, and then it did really rather well, going from 65 in 2001, or at the beginning of 2002, to over 200 in the end of the third quarter in 2003. It was really after the period in 2007 that it started to underperform relative to gold. What I also find particularly interesting right now, in terms of the gold price, are the parallels that we have with what was going on back in the period between about 2000 and 2003. Because if we simply zoom in on the, I'm sorry, I've done the wrong thing. If I zoom in on this period, we had a major move on the upside in 2000, or in 1999, and that broke the downtrend. It took about 3 years to exceed that spike peak, and then we were in a new bull market. And during that time, we had volatile ranging. It even got all the way back down and tested the lows. It wasn't really until the beginning of 2002 that people started to really start to get interested in gold, because they had confirmation that not only was gold not going to break down to new lows again, but that it was capable of sustaining higher levels. And now think about the significant move that we had in 2016. That broke the downtrend in rather emphatic fashion. And over the course of the last 3 years, we've had volatile ranging. The price did not get all the way back down to the lows, but it was the ability of the price to find support in 2018 and subsequently rally, and now find support in the region of the trend mean and push on to new high ground. This is almost identical to the kind of base formation we had back in 2001. Of course, we're going to have to see gold, in fact, sustain the move above the $1,350 area and improve upon that performance before we start to get a lot of interest coming into gold. But we are in a very similar set of circumstances, that it is the purchasing power of fiat currencies is imminently going to be questioned. There is, and this needn't necessarily be about inflation. The deflationary forces that were very much in evidence in the period after 2008 is probably a better corollary. When we think about the fact that its negative real interest rates are the primary tailwind for gold prices. Whether that is during an inflationary cycle where central banks do not raise interest rates in enough to exceed the inflation rate, or the inflation rate is so low that interest rates have to are falling faster to try and stimulate the inflation level. Well, that is very clear in terms of what we're seeing with the gold price today. Investors are pricing in the potential that we are moving, that we have hit the peak in interest rates. And when we think about the Fed funds rate, it's been trending downwards since 1980, and this sequence of lower rally highs is still intact. And there is the potential here that we are going to, that we've seen the top of the interest rate cycle, that when the Federal Reserve starts cutting, that they may not be able to stop, and that we could be moving towards a negative interest rate environment in the USA over the course of the next decade. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to see it right away. But if they're starting to cut rates now, then where we are potentially in is the beginning of the bubble phase. If we are in the bubble phase, then we're going to see asset prices accelerate from where they are today. That will eventually cause the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. They may come back to the 2.5% level. It would be at that point that people would then start to get really interested in the bear market hypothesis, because then we would have many more of the factors that would really support a decline in the markets falling into place. But one thing we know for certain is that we are late in the cycle. And the dispersion of returns that we're getting in terms of stock markets is important, because the S&P and the Dow Jones are right in the region of their respective trend means. But the NASDAQ hasn't quite done it yet, although it still has a more convincing bull market chart pattern. But the Russell 2000, on the other hand, it has pushed back above the 1500 point level, but it hasn't quite been able to push back above the trend mean. And this does look like a much less consistent pattern. That's been the case for quite some time now. So it's going to have to hold. It's definitely going to have to hold the lows put in 3 weeks ago. Then when we think about the S&P 500 Banks Index, well, banks are liquidity providers, and they should do reasonably well in a liquidity-fueled environment. But we are in a very low interest rate environment, and if interest rates continue to compress, and which does appear likely in the short term, then that is going to represent a headwind for the banking sector. And because we have a flat yield curve, then they are also inhibited from making a margin on borrowing short and lending long. So banks are also something that are really worth keeping an eye on in terms of the liquidity pass through into the general economy. Well, when we think about the fact that the industrials average is at the highs, the transportation index looks a lot more like the Russell and the banking sector. And when we think about the need for interest rate cuts, it's in these sectors that really require an interest rate cut. The mega cap shares probably don't need it quite as much. They're not as capital intensive. They're not really as reliant on imports from overseas as some of the more conventional sectors. Then when we think about the fact that the consumer staples sector is continuing to do well and is right in the region of its peak, the utilities sector has been particularly impressive on the upside, and not least because of the contraction in government bond yields. The outperformance of utilities is obviously highly defensive, and the continued performance of the consumer staples sector is also highly defensive. When, for example, we look at the performance of Kellogg, I believe that was one of the shares that was at pushing on to new high ground in here, or pushing a new high in terms of the recovery today. There are obviously winners and losers in terms of the consumer staples. Some have been under a great deal of pressure. That's been most apparent in the apparel sector. And Gap, for example, is right in the region of the lows from 2016. This looks like something that is really extremely oversold. And but of course, it's probably going to require a catalyst for a recovery to start to come through. Just because the market is breaking on the upside does not necessarily mean that all shares are doing well. There are a significant number of those that are more reliant on the domestic US economy are succumbing to the increasing competition that we're getting from the retail sector, the grocery sector, and the consumer staples sector. Then, of course, there are those that are doing much better. Procter & Gamble continues to push new highs. Microsoft, as one of the major mega cap shares, is continuing to push new highs. Cisco Systems, which adopted the subscription business model and is engaged in 5G infrastructure, was at another new high in here today. What's also, I think, really quite important is that the NASDAQ, and I don't exactly know the ticker for that. There we go, was also at a new high in here today. And generally speaking, when exchanges are doing well, the stock market is doing well. That's, I think, one of the success stories of the financial sector over the course of the last decade. They've benefited enormously from co-location. They've benefited from the provision of liquidity. They've benefited from the number of shares that are now listing. And exchanges are tending to be among the better performers in terms of this bull market. The fact that companies like the London Stock Exchange and NASDAQ are doing better, that is representative of the continued flow of liquidity into these markets. Now, there is no denying that some of these shares are starting to become somewhat overextended, but these continue to represent consistent trends. They are the kinds of companies that continue to do well from a liquidity-fueled environment. And I think that's where we're likely to see the true bubble risk arising. It's in these companies that benefit from the provision of liquidity in no uncertain terms. And the continued strength of the US consumer is also something that is helping to boost these companies. Well, obviously, some of the big mega cap companies are starting to see some stress coming through in terms of antitrust. And Amazon, in particular, is one of those companies. So is Google. But what I think is particularly important in here is that when we think about the outlook for some of these larger cap companies, they have lost consistency. They represented some of the most impressive trends on the upside, and now they have lost consistency. Now, leaders lead for a reason. And in this case, the reason was access to liquidity and technological innovation. Well, they're still technical leaders. They are still among the great beneficiaries of the advance and pace of innovation in the technology sector. But now they are at a size where they need something new to really drive technological innovation and the advance in their share prices. Well, for Google, that could be autonomous driving, and Waymo is certainly the leader in that. But obviously, they need to deliver it, and that's obviously not something that is going to happen tomorrow. For Amazon, they need to continue to build out their network, and that's no easy thing when you already are as large as Amazon is. Therefore, when we look at what are the things that are performing, it is the ones that are very much liquidity fueled. When we think about fintech, we think about payments and the subscription business model, then these are the sectors that are doing particularly well. Then we have the gold sector. So gold is a hedge against the loss of purchasing power of fiat currencies, and or at least the debauchment of the purchasing power of fiat currencies, which is a very real phenomenon. That's an equally important factor for Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is within $100 of testing the $10,000 level once more. For something that is in limited supply, then this is a also a hedge against the potential for currencies to be debauched. That's let me see, that's the Ethereum price is also on a recovery trajectory and moved on to a new recovery high in here today. So we're continuing to see that gold and cryptocurrencies are rallying for the same reasons, even though they are completely different asset classes. Now, when we look at the move that we've had in the 10-year treasury, we're starting to see that increasingly large numbers of people are talking about 1% in terms of the yield, and we're starting to see that forecasts for future potential are getting exaggerated. Well, that generally suggests that we've already had a big move and it is due some consolidation. There's a very deep overbought condition in government bonds, and there is certainly scope now for some consolidation of that. But it would require a very meaningful pullback to question the longer-term trend of compression. The most important thing that government bonds have done has been to fail to sustain the move above 3% late last year. And the dynamic of the failure suggests that we're going to come back down and test the lower side of the range, and that's around 1.5%. But the downtrend is still intact. And the total return on 10-year treasuries is still now trending higher. We've had a meaningful rally over the course of the last 6 months, and this has reasserted on the upside. It's going to have to sustain a move below 2000 to question that this isn't still a bull market for bonds. We've had a loss of consistency, we've had a loss of momentum, but this was a cracking advance in bonds over the last 6 to 9 months, and in order to truly confirm that we are at the end of a bull market in bonds, this would have to sustain a move below 2000. And that's a big ask at the moment, against a background where we would have to see a true revolt by bond investors at the quantity of debt that is being created. And if central banks are willing to start buying it again, then there is literally no limit to how much debt can be created. And I think that is one of the most important points, that we're at a point today where there is a clear potential that we're moving into a bubbly phase that is going to be, I think, representative of almost a clear intention to expand valuations, to try and get this expansion to last longer. That's likely to also help to boost emerging markets, and particularly those that are allies of the USA. This trade war with China isn't something that's likely to end. It may ebb and flow, and there may be times when it gets better rather than worse. But China has stated that they want to be the global hegemon. They want to be the country that is the preeminent technological and geopolitical leader, and they're not going to get there without some opposition. And I think that's something that is likely to persist and to remain a factor for the foreseeable future. India, on the other hand, remains a US ally, and this market has got the potential for governance to improve, and that's an unlikely prospect in China. But what we are seeing in China is that the currency has strengthened over the last couple of days, and the stock market has at least bounced from the region of the trend mean. I think the big difference between China and India is that China is a trader's market. There will be opportunities, and this pop on the upside that we've had this week is encouraging. But it is a trader's market. It's more of a market to be in and out of, whereas India is best bought following reactions, and it's a highly emotional market, so there will be reactions. What I find rather interesting right now is that the market is at a new high. The banking sector is leading on the upside, and that and the bank of or the RBI is cutting interest rates. But there are pockets of stress in the Indian market. Right now, Yes Bank has been among the most heavily sold off, but it had an upside key reversal yesterday. Some of its biggest exposures are to, for example, D1 financing or housing finance. And D1 has debt that is trading in around the 30 level, so that's a rather extraordinary decline that's been seen. It's still current on its debt. Now, the big question is it going to be bought out by a private equity, or is it going to be able to raise finance in order to sustain itself? Then, when we think about Reliance Communications, well, Reliance Industries has been among the best performers in the index, and the other brother hasn't been doing especially well. Well, Yes Bank also has exposure to Reliance Communications, and that share is still trending downwards, although it has begun to at least lose some momentum on the downside. What I thought was also interesting in here today is that some of the other exposure that the bank has is to India Bulls, and that is looking increasingly likely that it has just made a failed downside break. Well, what this is suggesting is that there is the need for a capital infusion. It's increasingly likely that there will be a capital infusion, but this is all happening against the background of a secular bull market in India. So pockets of weakness will inevitably occur, and it will be a measure of the improving standards of governance in India that they can be dealt with in a rational fashion. What's happening in China in terms of the massive quantity of debt that's been built up in the regional banking sector is that it's very hard to monitor. We can't simply pull up share prices and look at the funding mechanisms, or we can't listen to their boards and let them ha or their co during conference calls ask them questions about where their financing requirements lie, where are their exposures, how much do they have, where are their liquidity provisions going to come from. And that's the big difference between the markets. The system of governance in China is not conducive to international investors being able to have confidence. There is no free press, there is no respect for minority shareholder interests, and the simple fact is that governance is not improving. And if governance is not improving, it means that the risk of loss is exponentially high. The other point, of course, is that India has got defaults. It's been having defaults for a long time. We know what the default rate is in India. It's probably higher than people are used to in places like the USA, but they have capital markets that are similar to what we're used to. In China, they've just started to allow defaults. We don't know what the natural default rate is, and that's a massive known unknowable. It's not even a known unknown. We just cannot know what that level is. When we look at the banking sector in China, we're presented with an index that is comprised of all of the large state-owned banks. So when we look at the index, it is bouncing and doing so in a reasonably dynamic manner. And that is entirely state-sponsored. Well, bull markets in China are state-sponsored, so this is good news. But it hides the true problems in the market, which reside in the regional banking sector. And we just can't monitor those regional banks. They're not listed. And that is where the big questions reside. But it's also why China is willing to run massive deficits. And that massive deficit, and it was $585 billion last year. That big deficit in China is the reason why we're one of the primary reasons that we have liquidity-fueled bull markets globally. China's willingness to continue to support its regional banking sector and to provide the liquidity necessary is one of the most important factors in supporting this bull market. I think it's also worth highlighting that when we think about the outlook for China, then it's the Australian market and the Canadian markets are among the most heavily exposed, but Australia in particular because of its reliance on commodity exports to China. The ASX 200 has been racing on the upside so far this year, and it's at new recovery highs. I think it is quite likely we're going to go back and test the 2011 peak. What's also worth highlighting is that the Australian dollar remains quite weak, but because of the efforts underway to weaken the US dollar, it has been bouncing over the last couple of days. But it's the 70-cent level is going to be the true arbiter of the ability of the Aussie dollar to continue to rally from here. Australian property prices are in their biggest correction in years. But when we look at the commodity sector, and most particularly the price of gold in Australian dollars, then this is a more impressive rally for gold in Aussie dollars almost since we've seen the big move at the end of 2011. This is one of the most impressive rallies for gold in any currency. It's obviously starting to also highlight the fact that Australia needs stimulus, that they're going to be cutting interest rates. They have absolutely no interest in supporting the Australian dollar. That it's quite unlikely that we're going to see the Aussie dollar get back above 70 cents. If it were to get back above 70 cents, that would further encourage additional interest rate cuts. The pressure that is coming to bear on China as a result of the trade war is heavily dependent on them continuing to run deficits to support their economy. If China does in fact start to feel greater pressure, then Australia will start to feel that pressure. That will put additional downward pressure on the Australian dollar and further upward pressure on gold. Therefore, the gold mining sector in Australia, which has already been a world beater, and those companies are cashed up and beginning to think about the potential for additional upside. Well, Newcrest, for example, has very clearly broken out of this 3-year range and is exploding on the upside. there is a clear potential that it is going to exceed the peaks put in back in 2010, and not least because of the company's valuation. And it was raising dividends at 33% last year. There is the potential for that to increase if they can avoid the temptation to get out there and start spending too much money on acquisitions. They've so far done that, and that has helped to support the stock price. If we start to bring it all together, we are in a secular bull market, but this portion of the bull market has been supported by the provision of liquidity. It does look like we're in the throes of the next big infusion of liquidity, and valuations are already high, so that does raise the potential for a bubble to occur. The primary factors that are supporting the secular bull market hypothesis are the rise of the global consumer, and that's still very much intact. Then we have the I guess the march of technology and the advances that we're seeing in artificial intelligence and neural networks, at the pace of innovation that that is helping to enable. Those are secular in nature, and they're likely to kind of to create the kind of efficiency gains and productivity gains that can justify a secular bull market. And then we have the fact that we have a massive sources of new supply of oil, and that has completely changed the geopolitical makeup of the global economy. It is really no longer in the USA's interests to have very low oil prices. They don't particularly want to have very high oil prices, but the break-even for production for a good part of US onshore production is about $50. So the USA wants to have a price in the region of about $50. Well, that suggests that we're probably going to be ranging between 40 and 80 for the foreseeable future. But there are some estimates that we're going to see the USA becoming one of the most pivotal swing producers of oil by 2030. Now, if that does in fact become the case, then that is going to further polarize the global economy, because there will then be an additional reason apart from the military umbrella, but also it will become an energy umbrella that the USA will control. That's a very significant geopolitical change, because it will further distance Russia from the USA's sphere of influence. Russia is a major producer of oil. Iran is also a potentially large producer of oil. China is a major consumer. One would have to think that if China is going to reach its long-term goals, then they are either going to have to figure out how to consume less, which is why they are adopting electric vehicles, or they're going to have to secure supply. Well, that could potentially be with Russia, most particularly if Europe starts consuming less of Russia's energy. That would also free Europe up from playing nice with Russia because of their dependence on Russian energy. Therefore, we can anticipate that the long-term change in terms of the supply outlook for oil, where the USA, having been the biggest consumer, becomes one of the biggest exporters. That will further polarize the global economy, that there will be the clear winners and losers. There will also likely be a secular bull market. That's also one of the most important factors in supporting the bull market hypothesis for the USA. what I find particularly interesting is that the narrative that has been so prevalent over the last decade has been that this is China's century, that it is the rise of China is by far the most important factor in any secular hypothesis over the long term. What gets almost no airplay is the countervailing argument that the USA turning from being a massive energy importer to being a massive energy exporter and being the leader in terms of technological innovation is going to fuel a secular bull market that will allow it to accelerate away from China in terms of its GDP growth and the efficiency of its economy. What seems to get no airplay in terms of this argument is how much of China's growth over the last decade has been debt fueled. And the difference, of course, is that with deteriorating standards of governance and misallocation of capital, that's a larger problem in China than it is in the USA. And it's already a big issue in the USA. If I had to think about where the real risks are, it's in non-bank lending. The fact is that the US banking sector has delevered, but that leverage has simply been transferred to non-bank lenders, most particularly in the private equity sector. And it's also been transferred to the corporate sector. Corporations are now much more levered than they were before. Well, what that suggests is that when we do eventually get to the end of this cycle, when this liquidity-fueled bull market and bubbly phase eventually does end, then the problems are going to be in private equity. They're going to be in corporate balance sheets and debt leverage, rather than any other sector in particular. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.